February 18th, 2020, session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KV0S. This week, I've been doing a few things both for OpenHP SDR, again, continuing on my graphics programming, making little headway, but bits of other projects creep in the way. So hopefully make some more headway soon. Also, I've been doing some website work. I do have some things I want to show tonight, changes that will affect Mike and potentially Tom. So maybe later in the session I'll show those. That's about it for me. Next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, everyone. I've been working on things related to the magnetometer, largely getting some minimal documentation and code to Frankie and Troy for them to be able to make measurements. I guess they got it going. Otherwise, I've been pretty, you know, it's been taking up most of my time. A few other things too. I'd like to spend some more time on code, but I haven't had. Time gets away from me pretty fast. That's pretty much what I've got done. Just over to y'all.
Very good, Dave. Next on the list, we have Homan, KD2MCR. Go ahead, Homan.
Hi, good evening. This is Homan Kim, KD2MCR. Yeah, I have nothing to report right now. I'm just looking forward to hearing from Dave about magnetometer development. So, okay.
Very good. Next on the list, we have Mike, AA8K, shown as recording in a way. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. Next, we have Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead.
Hi, Dave. Thanks a lot. Things are going fine here in Scranton. This week, I got all of the abstracts in for the HAMSA workshop. They were all due this weekend, so I'm working on putting them into a spreadsheet and getting them organized to send off to the science program committee, and then I'll be working on letting everyone know what the program will be. So that's the main thing for this week. W2NAF, back to that.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Tom, N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Good evening to everybody in the group. Been a busy week. We had a conference call with the board layout person for the receiver. We quickly got into the we have too many parts and not enough square inches mode. So we may have to make a few little tweaks, but overall pretty good. I'm comfortable that the board layout person that Scotty selected is knowledgeable, and I think we have a good team there. And secondly, I started on a first draft of the paper for HAMSCI, trying to organize the topics that we'll cover in the receiver portion. And there's not much time, and so we have to be pretty careful about picking and choosing what we do. And that's about it for the week.
Fine business, Tom. And next on the list, we have Troy, AC8XP. Go ahead, Troy. Not sure if Troy's there right this minute. We'll come back to him in a little bit. Next on the list, we have Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, thanks, Dave, and good evening to you and good evening to the net. It's been busy the past couple of weeks. As you know, we had a good session at the Orlando Hamcation, explained the Tangerine to a lot of potential users, made some new contacts of other organizations that might be interested in, such as a group that does radio astronomy and studies the atmosphere of Jupiter and some things like that, that might be interested in buying a bunch of our devices once they're ready to go. After that, I attended the International Space Weather Action Team thing at Cape Canaveral, as I was requested to do, and talked with them about how they might use some of the data that I've been collecting from RBN and PSK and Whisper and DX Cluster, but also data that we will be able to collect using the Tangerine, and their possibility that they might be able to use those data in order to verify, validate, correct their ionospheric models. 98% of what they talked about in the meetings, I was not able to follow because it was very, very deep into ionospheric modeling and the all of the issues therein, which I really have never been involved with. So it was kind of baffling. But I mean, they appreciated the. I did give them a talk about what we're going to be doing, and they did seem like at least Larissa Goranchenko from MIT Haystack was interested, but she knew all about, you know, she knew a lot of what I was talking about. Anyway, after that, returning back here, I haven't had a chance to work on the tangerine very much, except dinking around a little bit with trying to add some additional channel capability that Scotty and I talked about when we were in Orlando. This week is being taken up with writing another grant application that is for the university, but it's law enforcement related. So that's going to take up most of my time this week. The good news is it's due on Friday, so I'll be able to get back to this probably starting next week. A couple of little cool things. I got a couple of interesting QSL cards the last couple of days. I got one from Pitcairn, and working Pitcairn is about as rare as hen's teeth. And also a card from K1JT, Joe Taylor, the Nobel laureate who invented Fox Tango 8. Interestingly enough, I worked him on Meteor Scatter on MSK-144. But anyway, so back to net.
Those are real gems to have, Bill, so congratulations. Next on the list is Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you, Dave, and hello, everyone. Well, I spent the week before last at in Orlando and had a great time. Met a lot of people. There was, as Bill mentioned, a lot of interest in Tangerine SDR on a number of different levels. I think for this week, I've been pretty busy at work, but I'm going to try to get my Raspberry Pi 4 board up and running and see if it is going to be a candidate for our single board computer. I've had it for about 3 months now, and I haven't done much with it. So I think it's about time to fire things up and get moving along. Anyway, that's about it from here. Back to you, Dave.
Fine business. That brings us to the end of the list. Our leader, Scotty, hasn't shown up. Does anybody know if he's likely to show up tonight?
I haven't talked to him since Orlando, to tell you the truth. I'm not sure what he's up to. I know that, you know, he was off on holiday today, so I'm not sure what he's up to.
I talked to him Friday morning. We had several hours with the board layout guy, Scotty, and I Friday morning, and you know, so my guess is he probably just forgot this evening.
Yep. And I did want to let everybody know, on the Tangerine website, on the first page, I did add Scotty's and Bill's interview with Jason. And so now there are two videos on the first page, and they overlap somewhat, but there's more details in the second one. So you can take a look at those. The one thing I was going to tell people about is I'm working on a alternative look for our two pages, the document page and the TeamSpeak page. And I want to show people what it would look like. I have shown it to Dave Witten, but just a minute, and I'll paste a link up there, and you can take a look at it. If you click on this link, it's just a test page. But it would be an example of what the TeamSpeak sessions would look like. And it's a little more like the rest of our pages than the one that we have now.
I think it looks nice, Dave.
I was planning to... This just picks up whatever files are in the directory. So those of you that post to the directory, there would be no change. And it just picks them up, and it allows you to sort them. The other one does too, but most people don't know that. And I also wanted to make the documents file page look like this as well. So I just didn't want to scare anybody by adding them without telling anybody. And then particularly for people like Tom or Bill, Mike, that post to those directories, there's no change in what you have to do.
Good. No change is easy. I like the layout of the page, Dave. It looks really nice.
I tried to maintain all the colors and, the title bars and I borrowed some bits and pieces of code to make it a little simpler for me to write it. I didn't write it completely from scratch.
Yeah, the column headings seem to work. If you click on them, they sort and up or down. Seems to work real nice.
Yep. I have thought also about maybe not for the documents, but for the TeamSpeak, and I'd like Mike's idea about this. I'd like to make one per year so that you don't we've only been going a little over a year on this site, but Mike and I have a site at OpenHPSDR that has gone on for many years, and I'm thinking dividing it up by year would be a nice thing to do.
Sure. Can that just be implemented as a directory?
Yes, they would just be directories with the year number on it, and then you'd put your files in that directory, and then Mike seems to like it too. So that's what I'm going to do. I just thought I'd give everybody a heads up before I do it.
All right, thanks for the heads up. Yeah, that looks real easy to use, and having it all done by the directory makes it simple to manage.
Yep. I have another thing for Nathaniel. I wanted to let you know a little serendipity. I was talking to the director of our school, who is a meteorologist, and I was telling him about our project, and he said, "Are you guys related to any other projects?" And I said, "Well, which ones?" And turns out an alum of our school is Dolores, and I never know if it's Kip or Nip. Do you know, Nathan?
Oh, yeah. I would usually say Dolores Knip. She was the editor of Space Weather Journal for quite some time, and so she encouraged me to submit some of the papers that I did to that journal. And yeah, she's very, very prolific in the space weather field.
Yes, and 10 or 12 years ago, she did a sabbatical here, and that's where I learned about space weather. And it turns out she's going to be here in Columbia on Monday, next Monday, looking at a site to put in a magnetometer. So I got myself an invitation to tag along with the other people in the group and catch up with her. She's also, my brother-in-law was an atmospheric, he got a degree in atmospheric science, and they were classmates. So I have a double connection there. So I'm going to see if we can work it out and maybe mount one of our magnetometers somewhere near theirs as well, if it doesn't interfere.
That sounds great. Yeah, definitely. Please talk with her and tell her I said hello too.
I will. I was going back through Space Weather Journal articles, and I found one by you a few years ago.
Yeah, she actually put us, she put me on the cover of Space Weather Quarterly one year, and then included a brief write-up about HamSci and this ham radio stuff when I first started publishing.
Yeah, she's a very nice person, so I can understand that she would do that.
Yeah, she's great.
So this is another one of those areas where my old day job and what I do now intersect a little bit. And people wonder, well, why am I doing this when my background is a forester? I just tell them I'm interested in lots of stuff.
Oh, Scotty has showed up.
Both are sciences, right?
Yeah, yep. And hey, they are maybe less directly space weather, but weather is definitely interacts with trees. Scotty, you missed the roll call, but we'll give you a chance to give your roll call.
Okay, sorry, I'm late. I was sitting here on the computer and working away on other stuff, and I missed it. So anyway, probably the only significant thing that Tom covered, we've been working a little bit on the radio module, the RF module, and got it down to, I think, just a couple of connector issues is all that we're facing, right, Tom?
Well, yeah, and a little bit of a space crunch. I haven't heard from Dave yet on the filter module sizing and if we have enough square inches or not. But other than that, yeah, things look pretty good.
I think he did a placement, and it fits with the new size that we had on the board in our interactive session. But I think that was a lot bigger than what he originally had. So we're going to end up having to grow the board, I'm afraid. But he sent us the placement. He copied both of us, didn't he?
Well, I'll go back and look at the last one I've got. He's not been getting my emails at all.
Oh yeah, I hate it when that happens. We have a few customers with the emails. They just flat don't work. The emails get lost. You send them and they go into a black hole.
I have that problem sometimes with people sending stuff to me because I have AT&T email and they have an extremely aggressive spam thing where they'll prevent it from ever reaching your mailbox at all. So yeah,
Scotty, I just checked through. I have not received any layout update from Dave.
Okay, let me go look and see, because I distinctly remember getting something from him, but that memory isn't been so good these past few weeks.
No problem. You've got a lot to worry about.
Has Troy come back? We haven't heard from him either.
No, I was waiting to see if he'd come back and join in. Troy, are you there?
Yeah, I think I'm here. I jumped on the computer that has the strange keyboard that doesn't allow the push to talk to work, but I can switch over to the voice activation when I'm ready to talk, and I think that's okay. But anyway, hey, I wanted to thank Dave for all the help this week. He must have been working pretty hard because he was able to send Frankie and I the magnetometer support board along with Pi hat for the I2C or the Quick Connect. So we were able to get it up and running on the Pi. In fact, I'm watching the data scroll in one of the other windows right now. And I think we're getting off to a good start. And so our goal for this week is to see if we can kind of look at the data and see if the data makes sense, and then also we'll work on an installation where we can maybe get it outside and get it away from some of the magnetic influences in the house. So thanks a lot, Dave. We really appreciate that.
I'm really glad it's worked for you so far. I still can't swear to those numbers that you're seeing. They make me nervous too. Unfortunately I'm going to have to, I'm leaving Thursday morning. I've got to go to Dallas, and I'll be back Sunday night. So I'll be kind of out of pocket, later this week. But I'll be checking my email for what it's worth.
Great. Then thank you. We'll send you if we have questions. And, again, it's just, going to be a little bit of, orientation, learning how to use it, and of course we can compare it to the data that we're seeing from the sample program. So that'll be good to have.
Yeah, that's the thing that interests me the most is how it compares to the demo board from that I sent you from PNI. I also have another of those demo boards, but I simply haven't had time to do all the things I want to do. All of a sudden, another paper's popped up that I had to work on from another project that I thought would be long dead by now, but they want to submit it, and so I've had to do some editing on that as well. So it's been a little crazy, but I'll try to be as responsive as possible.
Fine business. Yeah. And I think the Frankie's goal was to either set it up to log or be able to pull it in through like a CSV so that we can, start making some charts to send to Hyman and his team. So anyway, thank you very much.
Yeah, hey, Tom, if you check your Gmail account for the 14th on Friday, buried in the email, there is a placement for the filter module.
Okay. Let's see. The last one I got was the email where he said we have an online session, and I got nothing after that.
So you got the one where he suggested he gave you a Gmail account to send to?
No, I did not.
Okay. Well, okay. Let me try sending it to you and see if you get it.
Oh, this is terrible. We're having two-way. He can't send me an email to tell me about his new email because I can't get it. And I can't send him one saying, what's your new email? Because he can't get mine. This is terrible.
Scotty, you're the common denominator.
Oh, that's scary.
I have another comment. There are people showing up on OpenHPSDR wanting to use things like Hermes for radio astronomy.
Yeah, I saw that. I didn't read the rest of the thread, though.
Well, you know, Joe, K5SO, has been doing that all along. And that's why he wanted to be able to have diversity or coherent receivers, and that was his motivation for that. So there are people who've been doing it, but they don't talk about it very much.
Yeah, a guy came up to me from Project Radio Jove at Hamcation, and he was all excited, saying that the Tangerine was going to do things for them that no other radio so far could do. So he was all excited about getting one to play with.
We're going to have Dr. Xing Feng from the Radio Jove project at the HamSci workshop. He'll be giving a talk there. And I'm sure he'll be very interested in talking with you about the Tangerine SDR too.
Great.
Yeah, Xing is the one who's been, he's actually been leading the paper that Dave Typinski has been working on.
I think Dave was the guy I talked to.
Yeah, that's right. Dave was the heavy set gentleman there with the blonde hair, I believe.
Yeah. And let's see, who was the? Because there was one point of they were trying to do one point of contact. But then Dave said, "Well, he was going to talk to me directly anyway, so he was going to keep in radio silence until Hamcation when he met me." So I don't remember who was the guy he was working with. Do you remember?
That was there at Hamcation?
No, he was not at Hamcation, but I talked to him via email before I met Dave.
Probably. Was it Xing?
No, it wasn't. Let me go back in my email and see who it was.
Jim Sky, maybe?
No, it doesn't sound familiar.
There's someone else I met. I don't remember the name off the top of my head, though.
Larry Dodd, maybe?
Okay, I don't know him.
He sent me a document from the technical team about their SDR specification.
And did that look like we were meeting what they needed to?
Yes, it did. And it was only just a bullet list. It was very hold on a second here. I'm looking through it. It was only like 2 pages.
Yeah, I think I remember when you sent. I think you sent that out, didn't you?
I think I did. I forwarded it to the list. I think one of the questions, they want a noise figure of less than 5 dB, and I don't know if that's something we can meet. Tom, you probably would know the answer to that.
It's going to require a preamplifier to do that.
Yeah, now it's coming back to me. I think you had made that comment that that's what's going to be required. But I think all of the other tasks, all the other bullet items, I think we can meet.
Yeah, as my recollection from a few months ago is they had an extraordinarily stringent requirement for spurious. They can only be a few, and they can only be very low in amplitude.
That's right. So, and the range that they're interested in is 15 to 35 megahertz.
Yeah. So the one about spurious responses concerned me. That's an extraordinarily difficult spec.
Yeah. No spurs within 9 dB above the noise floor. 1 spur 6 dB. 2 spurs 3 dB. 4 spurs less than 3 dB above the noise floor. So that's what that's the one you're talking about, right?
Yeah, that one's a challenge.
Is that because they're planning on doing so much integration of the spectrum?
I think that's right. And so these spurs would be integrated with the real signals, and they don't want to disturb the integration that we do.
Yeah,
that sounds about right.
Yeah, the there's a couple of considerations, and some of those spurs happen inside the ADC converter chip itself.
But so I guess the only problem would be is if a real signal landed on top of where the spur was, because we could subtract these out, but we might be subtracting out a real signal, which would be not desirable.
Yeah, it all depends on what the measurement is. If they're doing a wideband noise measurement, you could, in theory, notch out the spur frequencies, presuming they don't move.
Yeah, yeah, unless there was a real signal that fell there and you notched it out too.
Well, from a statistical point of view, they could run it with all the original data and run it with different filters and then compare the results from the variety of pieces. And that would let them analyze it. Now, maybe they're not ready to do that kind of comparison, but statistically, it's not that hard.
Yeah, if in fact you're looking to do a wideband noise measurement, they can notch out the spurs, but that makes the assumption that the spurs don't move, they tune exactly the same way, or something doesn't happen in the FFT depths or other things that move those spurious responses around. If they're just doing wideband energy integration and that's a problem, then there should be a way to remove them provided they're stationary.
Well, and it seemed to me that Phil Harmon experimented with this kind of thing. If, for instance, that the spurs tune, or sorry, if they don't tune, what you could do is you could take two measurements. Hold on a second. You could take two measurements and combine them, and you could end up being able to receive on the alleged spur frequency if it, in fact, met certain criteria. I seem to remember Flex did this too. So, for instance, if they knew that there was a spur on a particular frequency at a particular NCO setting, they would actually shift the IF off so that you wouldn't get any spurious response on the desired frequency that you're listening to.
Yeah, so if you're trying to do a narrow band measurement, you have to worry about those things. If you're trying to do a wide band measurement, then you have perhaps an easier solution.
Yeah, because if you took the wide band measurement and subtracted the spurs off and then moved the NCO and took another measurement and subtracted the spurs off in a different place, couldn't you figure out which was the spur and which was the, which, how much the spur contributed and how much the real signals did?
Well, again, if it's a wide band measurement, you really don't care.
So I guess what would have to happen is you'd have to have an awful lot of energy on those spur frequencies for it to make a difference.
Yeah, yeah. So again, you need to talk to them what the requirements are in terms of, you know, the total net integrated energy, the bandwidth, you know, are they looking for narrowband things, wideband things? That kind of a discussion would be required to see if there's a solution that would meet their objective without requiring, you know, very few and very low level spurs, because that, if as written, it's quite difficult to do.
And I would warrant that if it's quite difficult, it's probably quite expensive as well.
Yeah, I'm worried that as written, could we even find an A to D converter that was capable of doing it?
Yeah, because wouldn't we end up needing, I mean, it's much easier to do narrowband, like you said, right? Because you're decimating down and filtering. But for wideband, you don't do that.
Yeah, again, if it's wideband, you know, a few spurs aren't going to contribute much energy. If they do, you can just notch them out. And since you're looking in a wideband sense for the energy over a wideband, notching out a narrowband signal doesn't impact things very much. If it's a narrow band where you're trying to zoom into the behavior of a spectrum in very small FFT bins, then you have a more difficult problem where you, as you said previously, you might have something of interest show up in the same bin that you're trying to notch out, and then you have a real issue.
And I'm just curious where that requirement came from, because it seems to me they're doing wideband. So why are they so concerned with these small, way, 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 way low level spurs?
Yeah, that's why I think we need to have a discussion with them on why do those requirements exist in the form that they're written, and, you know, and is there some other way to approach the problem that might be feasible. So right now, my feeling is we're kind of guessing the intent of the specification.
Yeah, good point. So we ought to get clarification on that before you just assume that we can fix it.
Yeah, so right, exactly. So at any rate, if any of those folks are going to be at HAMSI, you know, we can chat with them either after the session or sometime and have that discussion. Nathaniel, do you know if any of the Radio Joe folks are going to be at HAMSI?
Yeah, I know that the NASA scientist, Xing Feng, he's going to be there.
Okay, it may be worth an introduction if he knows where that spec came from. We could at least talk with him and understand it.
How are you?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
How are you?
Good. I'm on a...
Troy, you're coming through.
So related to HAMSI too, let's see, I saw we've got this email chain going about the GPS requirements with Tom and John and Scotty. And so it looks like we need to get some firm numbers from the scientists. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different areas. There is John needs some pretty firm data in terms, you know, he's trying to compute jitter and wander and frequency offsets over time, things like that. So he needs some real data there. I'm trying to put together one slide that talks about interferometry that's outside of the GPS part. You know, there'll be things like dispersion and static phase offset that we're going to need that don't impact the clock module, that just impact the receiver, the antennas, the cables, the filters, antenna preamps, if we have any, those kind of things will also involve it. And so my hope is we can break it up into two independent discussions, John's on frequency stability, and then other related stuff that can mess up interferometry.
That sounds good to me.
Hey, Tom, do we need, this impacts what kind of accuracy we need on the absolute time, doesn't it?
Well, there's two separate subjects. I think we have an absolute time spec and a drift of time, you know, those kind of things. And then I think we have a separate set of topics related to how we do the interferometry and perhaps how the correlation software functions. And I suspect the VLBI guys could probably write a book on, you know, how to do all of that. And we may want to have we may want to break this into the two different pieces in terms of, you know, how wide band is the correlation that you're trying to do? How narrow band is it? For example, the filters, if we have two different filters, the component variation on the AM broadcast band stop filter is going to be enough that it's going to cause dispersion between two different receivers. And so we have to have the discussion of if we're going to do a wideband measurement, can we get rid of the AM band stop filter because it's going to make life tough. But then we have other issues like the feed lines are going to be different lengths to the antennas, and those are probably going to have temperature dependence, and so you're going to get dispersion and temperature-related dispersion effects. So there's going to be a lot of interesting sub-things that will get involved in how you do correlation that are, in fact, out independent of the GPS timing.
So does that mean, am I understanding you correctly that the filters themselves are not uniformly designed enough to be sure that, like, filter on one is going to have the same response as the filter on the other, and that could cause problems?
Yes, that's correct. Just due to component tolerances alone, they're going to have different group delays and they're going to have different time delays. Now, the second question is does that matter? And if you're trying to measure, if you're trying to do interferometry at one of those peaks of the group delay, you know, at 0.5 megahertz or 1.5 megahertz, the corners of the band stop, you're going to have, the different modules are going to have slightly different peak frequencies and peak amplitudes. So if you're trying to measure two different receivers right at that frequency, you could have an issue, and it might be better not to have the band stop filter in for trying to do that interferometry. But secondly, they're going to have slightly different time delays off of those peak frequencies. And so the question is, do we calibrate that out? Do we not have the filter? You know, there's a bunch of different questions we have to ask.
Okay, that sounds good.
We should be able to calibrate that with the noise source, right?
No, the noise source has uncorrelated noise between two different receivers. So, for example, if you have two receivers that are 20 miles apart, the noise sources between them are uncorrelated, so there's no phase information that can tell you about the two different filters. So I think if, in fact, we need to worry about that and they have to be at receivers 20 kilometers apart or 20 miles apart, then we're going to have to go and calibrate the phase response of the filters independently and then subtract that out in the post-processing software.
And, of course, each physical filter is going to have different phase response, right?
Yeah, that's right, because the inductors will be slightly different. The capacitors will have slightly different capacitance. And so if you're worried about tracking the phase response of the filters, then you're going to have to set up, calibrate, measure the phase responses of each individual module. But I think you have some of that else going on as well, because the antennas themselves, two different antennas are going to be different. They're going to be connected by feed lines, which are different. So there's a whole lot of error sources that can creep into that measurement. Depends on how accurate we need to be, the frequency it happens at. There's a lot of issues that ultimately we're going to have to perhaps keep track of.
So with a noise source, we could do an amplitude response, but not a phase response, because we don't have correlated noise. Is that right?
Right. We don't know, you know, a noise source, that's on the receiver module in one location is totally different than a noise source that's on a receiver module 20 miles away. And their amplitude responses might be similar, but you don't know the phase of the noise, and it's going to be totally random between the two sites.
So how do we actually, given a filter, how do we actually characterize that? We'd have to use lab equipment to do that, or is there, I'm just thinking ahead here, if we were to be able to characterize that and include that in an SDR's response when that particular filter was plugged in?
Yeah, so you need to characterize the exact filter's group delay or a phase response. And you probably do that by having a swept source. You make a measurement of the received signal through the filter from the swept source, and then you store that as a table of phase response versus frequency. And then in the software that post-processes it, likely, you tell it, go look up that file and undo what that filter did.
So could we, if we were to build a small low power transmitter module that we could plug into RFM2, would that give us the necessary, basically, essentially test equipment to check our filter?
That's one possibility. The other possibility is you can use lab equipment. I think there may be several ways to do that. I haven't really thought about how you would implement the hardware.
I'm just thinking it could be almost like a self-test, a self-sweep, if we had a transmitter. And if we designed it right, we could make it so that it really wasn't a transmitter. Its intended purpose was simply to check the receiver. So it's not, it wouldn't have to be licensed.
Yeah. There's a number of things. I think you're going to want to do all the post-processing for that in software rather than in the FPGA or anywhere on site. So I suspect you'll want to do that as part of the correlation function outside of the receiver and the data engine.
Right, but we could have a separate software routine that and the FPGA would basically just have to do a sampling and a report back, and then the software would do all the correlation.
Scotty, do you remember the papers that Phil did on detecting signals with chirp across Australia?
Oh, vaguely, a long time ago he did that before. It kind of faded away because I think he lost his receive. The guy who was doing the receive site in South Africa.
Yeah, this was his test beforehand. He was working on 15 meters, and he had a guy in Sydney, and he was sending, one was sending a chirp signal, and they were looking for ionospheric variations for detect propagation issues, And he was able to send chirp signals below the noise floor and pick them up all the way across Australia. Then he was trying to do it on 2 meters with South Africa, but the South Africans didn't want to participate. And so that never actually happened. But the technology that he wrote about, and I have those papers available, and he did it in collaboration with Australian ionospheric people who were also hams. So it may be part of the solution we would need.
Yeah, I remember that. He was working with a guy in Sydney, which is on, 3,000 miles away. And they had separate receive sites, but they were correlated in time and with using GPS. And he was able to detect, I think, the backscatter off of the low power signals, because he would integrate over a huge amount of time and over frequency. So he could get an ERP like bigger than a broadcast station.
Yes. And so the people, the whole reason for the project is people were using frequencies. I think that they were in the 6 meter TV transmitters, and they were using those as passive transmitters for them to detect these variations in the ionosphere. And when the TV frequencies all changed, they lost that ability, so they had to find another way to do it. And they didn't have the ability to put up a 50,000 watt transmitter, so they were able to do with a chirp transmitter at reasonable wattages basically the same thing.
Yeah, I remember he actually could do more EIRP than the broadcast stations by integrating over a long time and over a swept frequency. Because I think the problem was a lot of the TV stations that they were using as monitors were in Southeast Asia, and they were disappearing off the air at an alarming rate. So he was looking for a different way. But so you're thinking maybe the techniques could be applied to this problem?
Yeah, I think there's some information there that would be helpful in if you're trying to calibrate phased receivers.
Yeah, do you have those papers? You could forward them to the mailing list?
Yeah, I don't know if I can forward all of them, but I'll check and see. But I was really interested in that for a while, and so I've collected a bunch of that stuff.
Well, perhaps a directory on the server for that kind of stuff, if you think it's applicable.
Yes, I have no problem sharing them. It's just that I need to check and make sure none of them are in a couple of the published locations are really strict about their copyrights, and so and others are not. So I need to check and make sure before I pass them around.
Yeah, okay. And if they're really big, you probably don't want to email to 100 people anyway. So, but okay, hopefully they'll give permission to put them up.
My recollection is they were articles that were done for the RSGB magazine.
Yes. Some were in Australian, and I can't remember. I think one of them was in D-Bus.
To change the subject slightly, if that one has been pursued, I don't know whether I mentioned it to this collection of people, but I did get the I2C extender, at least, and it appeared to be working through a 100-foot cable. I have not had time to check it out rigorously.
Oh, that's great news, Dave.
Yeah, because I wasn't really sure that I believed it would work, but it seems to. And I think that's how long the cable is. It's just coiled up as I bought it, and I haven't used it in any realistic situation, but it did seem to work that way.
Yeah, testing it through a coil is a worse example than stretching it out linearly. So if it works that way, probably in good shape, except you stretch it out, you might pick up other things that interfere with it, but in a coil you wouldn't necessarily. But I remember when I worked at Division of Motorola, we were trying to get communications working over a long cable. I don't even remember what the the protocol, I mean, the levels were. But what we did is we took the cable, and I believe it was shielded cable. So get this, we ran it, we laid it on top of the fluorescent light fixtures in the factory, zigzag up and back and up and back. And boy, you talk about interference on the cable, you got it.
Well, my house is not wonderful. I've not done anything to try and keep the noise in check. I have all kinds of different noisemakers around here. So if it works around here, it'll probably work. But at least the initial indication is that a pair of these boards, as designed, powered with 5 volts over the shielded cable, for using differential I squared C, did seem to be transmitting the magnetometer and temperature results. But I didn't do anything to look for, you know, an extended period and, you know, check the, actually I just put some time stamps in the code, today, I think, or sometime in, and so I have to look for sequential, you know, make sure that nothing gets dropped. But so far the indications seemed, the wind was blowing in the right direction. So there's good hope.
Yeah, do you have any way you could measure the current draw of the system of just the boards on the 5-volt line?
Not accurately. I'd have to think about it, but I'm not really well instrumented around here. I have to think about it.
Well, you have a jumper on the board that supplies the 5 volts to the cable, right?
Right.
So you could put an ammeter across that and essentially putting the ammeter in series with the remote board.
Yeah. I could try it. But it would be nice. I'm sure you'd like to know. I don't think this thing draws much, though. It should be, well, you know, pretty close to the specs that Tom worked out.
Well, here's where I'm going with that, is that it occurred to me that we could solve my 5-volt problem, which it seems to be I'm the only one that has the problem. So what we could do is we could run the sensor on 2.5 volts, and we could regulate down from 3.3. The problem is, if you look at the spec for how much the extender draws, it draws so much current that you, from 3.3 to 2.5 volts, there's not enough headroom across the cable, across 100 feet of cable, so basically it won't work. Because I think the I2C extenders claim that they need 160 milliamps of current to operate, and you can't supply that amount of current across the cable, which is about, my calculations show it's about 3 ohms, and you only got 0.8 volts, so you got that drop across the cable, plus you've got the overhead of the LDO, and it just can't work.
So you're having...
I was just going to say, if you guys give us a quick note and show Frankie which pin she needs to measure, I can have her do that with a couple of different lengths of cable.
Yeah, that would be. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay. The board that you have, that Frankie has, is not the full implementation of this. That. Works. It doesn't have the I squared C extender component. Now, if you want to, you could measure the sensors alone. But all you have is the sensors. I have the only pair of even generally working full design boards, and even then, there's some loose ends. I need to do another spin.
Yeah, my recollection is the cable termination resistors, the 100 ohm cable termination resistance, was a significant part of the current draw.
Yeah, and the sensors draw like 2 to 3 milliamps. They really aren't much. It's the extender and you said the termination that's all required. So even though it's less at 3.3 than 5, still enough to make it. I think it's not going to work.
Yeah, so. the spec for the magnetometer has worked out requirements on the cables, cable resistance, cable gauge, voltage drop, all of that in the document.
And which document are you talking about?
The magnetometer requirements document that's on the Tangerine SDR website.
Okay, and you worked out, of course, you worked it all out at 5 volts, right?
Yeah, I worked it out at 5 and at 3.3.
Okay, because my thought was if you make the cable, if you run the cable or the extenders at 3.3 and you run the magnetometers at 2.5, then you eliminate the need for the 5 volts and you eliminate the problem of having the non-standard PMOD connector that has 5 volts on the power pins, but 3.3 volts standard on the switching pins.
Yeah, I think that may end up being difficult. I ended up having to spec, you know, two pairs of wires to cut the DC resistance of the cable just to get it to work from a 5-volt source.
Yeah, and 5 to 3.3 is 1.7 volt overhead. 3.3 to 2.5 is 0.8 volts overhead, so it's half. So it's it doesn't work.
Yeah, so at any rate, Dave, you may want to refer back to that document. I think there's tables in there that go through that.
Yes, I think I've looked at them several times, but I don't know, monkeying with it, changing the way you originally designed it makes me very nervous. I was very pleased to see that it worked at all.
Okay, very good. Yeah, it's pretty tight, and you know, the gauge of the wires in the cable is pretty fine.
And even now, I have not, you know, tested it rigorously. So don't know if, but don't know if there's anything I don't know.
Well, it would be interesting to measure the 5-volt current. So if you do get a chance to do that, I'm definitely interested.
I'll give it a try. For Troy and Frankie, you mentioned, Frankie mentioned that the value of the data return for the X vector, I guess you'd call it X vector, is, you know, conspicuously larger than the others. And that has always made me nervous, but I think I sent you the code that I had worked it out in my head, persuaded myself I couldn't think of a way to that I was screwing up, but it's not inconceivable that I'm doing something wrong. I do think that there is some way to save the results, or at least big batches of them, using that Windows app that they that the test for the demo board, and of course the code I sent you, you can just use a redirect to a since it's command line Linux, you can just do whatever you call it, greater than sign to a file name, and it should catch, I believe, most of the output.
Okay, we'll give that a try. We did run, I think it's you can run 10,000 measurements in the sample program, and we did put that into a spreadsheet, and Frankie was manipulating those numbers, and that's how she caught that the I think it was the X or the Y, X or the Y was much different, you know, in magnitude. Maybe we can see what's happening there, or figure it out. Again, we move the unit around a little bit, and it seems to be varying. So you know, there is some change, and of course Frankie was trying to figure out what that rate of change was. But we'll give that a shot and let you know how it goes. And if you're out of town, we'll give it to you by email.
Yeah, you'll notice if you watch, I think it's a Z value, and you elevate it slowly. Maybe it's the Y value. You elevate it slowly, and once you get around vertical, it drops to zero and then reverses sine, I believe. You know, it's responding, I suppose, rationally. I've just never known exactly what to expect. There's a lot of bit shifting and stuff not a lot. It's just a bit of bit shifting, and it's, you know, the most significant bytes or bits versus, you know, one way. You have to switch things around and do some juggling, and I was never absolutely sure I was doing that right, but I did follow the code example. There's some other code that I haven't sent you that the PNI people gave me. They have demo code, but it was written to build under the ARM embed development environment that ARM themselves puts out. And it looked like a real mess to try to make that code. It had some oddities in it anyway. But so I have never been dead certain I was doing the right stuff. But just beat on it a while and see what happens.
Yep, we'll do. I think, Frank, you'll be good for that.
It looks like we're up against our hour, so if there's anything else.
Okay, I'll take notes. I've captured that we probably have two side discussions at HamSci on tap here. And if anyone comes up with other side discussions we need just reply to the minutes.
Okay, and thanks, Tom, for doing that. I know it's kind of a thankless task, but it's appreciated.
Scotty, I got the email chain with the filter board and all that. Thanks for sending that.
Okay, good. Well, at least something's working now.
Yes, Scotty, you may have missed some emails from me as well, because there's a number that I've never seen any hint of a response to. So I don't know what goes on with the email.
Well, I saw the discussion you're having on the specification, I think, but I never saw any attachments come through, so I wasn't sure exactly what I should have commented on. Was there a document that I was supposed to look at?
I don't know which one you're referring to. There was one email where I sent you a very direct question that I was hoping you'd answer about the 5-volt thing. But actually there've been a couple of those and that I've never seen any response.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure that out. And I think I have figured out that the way I want to do it's not gonna work. So we're gonna end up having to go with one of your other suggestions, like the external 5 volts.
Okay, well, the external 5 volts is always there and always will be. So I don't have to do anything different for that. And the boards, I want to send off another order for more prototypes, because even when I get like 6 of them, I got 6 of them the other day, and I completely destroyed 2 of them somehow. And I don't know what I do. Well, I was just a bad morning for soldering. And I got 2 that seem to work, and I have 2 that I haven't touched yet, but they have to work in pairs. So I really would like to order a bunch more, but I didn't want to do that until we kind of knew where we were going.
Yeah, okay. I will go back and look at those and look for the specific questions. I apologize for missing that.
I think I just suggested putting the 5 volts on pin 1, because that is supposedly reserved in the spec for I2C interrupt, and which we're certainly not using here. And I can put a jumper that can totally disable it should somebody want that.
But then we'd have to supply 5 volts on that pin, and that's has the same problem as supplying 5 volts on the power pins and then running everything else at 3 volts. So again, let me go and review it. I think I'd rather stick with external power, and you already have that area covered.
That's fine with me.
Okay, well, I have to run, so I want to thank everyone for coming. Sorry I was late and missed the first part, but I'll go back and listen to the recording that Mike is going to post. Thank you again, Mike.
Well, I guess we'll say 73.
Thanks. Good call tonight. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, thank you very much. 73.